This session is from the 2021 Shepherd's 360 International Church Leaders Conference. For more information, visit shepherds360.org.
Okay, we kind of got off on that topic. For those of you that have not heard me yet, Attorney David Gibbs and National Center for Life and Liberty. And we work with churches across the nation. And this topic is helping protect your ministry from allegations of abuse. And let's start with that for a moment, okay? And I know you're here, which means you care about these issues. No, you're fine. Come on in, bro. You're responsible. I met the guy in last buys all the coffee, so we're going to hear Justin. So anyway, anything you can
do.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you look like a man of means, so we're excited to hear. But anyway. I'll give this to you. But with that, you know, we live in a world where a lot of times in the abuse universe, we think that won't happen at our church. And there's a lot of reasons why. We like the people we minister with. You know, we look around and we say, well, you know, these people in our Sunday school, these people in our congregation, some smaller churches, we're all related. We're family. We're from rural Kentucky. We're from this part of North Carolina. You know, we're good people. And so we live with the thought that, you know, while there's abuse, you know, we've heard about it in the Catholic world. We've heard about it, Southern Baptist leadership, big churches, you know, ministries across the universe. But it won't happen in our church. And what I often encourage folks to understand is more likely than not, abuse will not occur in your church. Okay, matter of fact, statistically, about 80% of the allegations, now remember, allegations, are ultimately proven to be false or exaggerated. Okay, so, I mean, I want to let you know, I don't want you to leave here thinking, oh man, there's abuse behind every bush, things are a mess. But the reality is, an allegation can destroy your church. Okay, innocent people can go to jail. So when people say, well, at our church, I don't think anybody would do anything, you're probably right statistically. There probably are good people. They're committed. They're decent. But an allegation can have as much negative impact as a predator within the congregation. And matter of fact, I would even go so far as to say an allegation is harder to deal with. Because in an allegation, you're always balancing this, you know, alleged victim and this alleged perfpetrator, and how to, and that's where churches get in a lot of trouble, because the victims say, well, they stood too strong with this guy or gal, or back and forth. You know, when you have an actual bad actor, somebody that's convicted in jail, well, it gets easy, right? You go, oh, it's horrible. He's bad. Poor victim. And so it makes it easier to manage. Horrific and reputation and negativity, but it's easier to deal with. But we live in a world where in your church you will have allegations that come forward. So maybe just to understand, nothing wrong needs to happen for an allegation to come forward. And so as you think about this, you know, and one of the things when you go back to your church is sometimes people go, ah, you went to a legal seminar, you went to a church conference, Shepherd 360, you got all worked up. And, you know, this won't happen here. You don't have to worry about our place. You know, those lawyers or those risk managers, those insurance types, they get you goosed up. But the reality is it won't happen here. And statistically, they may be right, but an allegation can be destructive. An allegation can take out everything within the church. Now, let's talk about, you know, dividing things. Okay, you say, as a church, how do we get in trouble for abuse? I mean, we understand a bad actor. We understand an abuser. We understand they can go to jail. We understand they can be sued. We understand they've committed horrible crimes. And we sit here today and we all agree, abuse of any form, you know, physical, emotional, sexual, I mean, the litany of things. And by the way, why don't I stop there for a moment? How many understand abuse properly defined? How many believe we do live in a world where the definitions are changing? Okay, so I do want to, I don't want to like get us off track here, but I do want to give you a little food for thought. You know,
I want to add to that, irrevocable trust does not mean irrevocable anymore.
Yeah.
Personal experience.
You're spot on. Uh-huh. Okay, the things can shift. So like right now, if somebody says this person took a child and did sexual things to them, we all agree, sexual abuse, horrible, shouldn't happen. This person went and told a child that he would die and burn forever unless he trusted Jesus Christ as his Savior. There are people that will start to advocate that's abuse. Okay, this person told this kid that was, you know, transgender that, you know, God didn't make them that way and they shouldn't be the, you know, they should stay with the gender of their birth. So how many understand we're living in a world where the definitions of abuse are moving, okay? So when I say we oppose child abuse, we absolutely do, zero tolerance, but let's keep it properly defined. Not preaching the gospel, not preaching morality, not encouraging them to do the right thing. I mean, we have in the world where, you know, you tell this young minority child to respect the police. That's somehow abusive or discriminatory. So, I mean, we're in a crazy world where a lot of definitions are afoot. But when we say abuse properly defined, you know, physical, emotional, sexual, neglect, you know, anything, we'd all agree that's inappropriate conduct towards a child. The abuser can get in a lot of trouble. How does the church get in trouble? Well, there are three ways you get sued for abuse. They will call it, you know, negligence, okay, which is you weren't careful. But there are three ways. They will get you for negligent selection. Okay, you weren't careful with how you selected your workers. They will, number two, get you for negligent supervision. You were not careful with how you managed or oversaw your workers and your people. Or number three, they will get you for what they call negligent retention. Now, retention is a little bit more of a fact specific. It's kind of a, you heard something, you knew something, and you failed to act. That would be kind of the Penn State model. Some of you might remember Paterno, who is now deceased, and you know, sad that that cloud fell on his legacy, and he went from being the winningest coach to kind of being castigated before his death. And everyone would agree that Coach Paterno did not abuse a child. There was never an allegation that he acted inappropriately towards a child. But what did Coach Paterno do? Well, he heard allegedly weird things about his assistant coach, Sandusky. Like, hey, he's in the shower with this guy, or there's some weird stuff going on. And so he began to hear some things. And the allegation, and I think it was ultimately proven to be accurate, is he didn't act. It's kind of like, well, weird, but not my problem. And so that was the concept. And so when you talk about retention, it's generally you were presented with something, you heard something, but you didn't handle it correctly. Now, those are the three ways you get sued. And by the way, that's how the Boy Scouts get sued. That's how the schools get sued. That's how the churches get sued. That's how any child caring organization gets sued. And you can get sued for any of the three or all of the three. Now, they will say, you know, you were sued for the abuse of a child. Well, the reality is churches don't abuse children. I mean, you've never been to a church service where they say, make a motion, we abuse the kids, all in favor. Not going to happen, right? That would be insanity. What you have is we weren't careful with our workers, we weren't careful with our supervision, or we retained somebody. We kept them in the position longer than we should have. Now, you say, well, who decides where this is? Well, if we can get a judge to deem that we acted correctly, there's good news here. The judge will dismiss the case. The judge will say, yep, this church did everything right, no case, and they were careful with their selection, they were careful with their supervision, they didn't have any issues on retention, and you will be out of court and win. But if the judge goes, well, you know, there are some questions here, there's some messy stuff, I think we need to let the jury decide. How many understand if you end up in front of a jury, it's not a good day? because the jury is going to be thinking, yeah, these people, they should have done more. And sadly, yes, ma'am.
This is a far reach, but
far what?
Go back into the church, and let's just say that there is a member in high standing in the church that is sexually abusing their child.
Yes, ma'am.
Nobody in the church knows about it, but if it is brought to light and actions are taken, could the church be sued for not dealing with this person?
Yes, they can be. And I don't want to depress you, but the facts that she put into her question that are problematic are the standing in the church. Okay, so let's use this. There's always wackos and weirdos that show up at church, right? Okay, and we obviously don't want them to behave wacky or weird, but they show up. We don't scream people at the door. We're a hospital for the hurting. So just because somebody attends does not create a legal liability. Okay, but now once we lift somebody up into leadership, okay, board member, teacher, choir member, platform presence, they've moved up, okay, they have some status, they're maybe what we call a significant volunteer, okay. Well, now we kind of own them a little bit. Now, here will be what the victim will allege, okay, this will be the victim's allegation. Because they had that position in the church, they were able to abuse me more easily, more often, or more protectively. So the victim will use the church status. So like, if my dad wasn't the chairman of the board and getting all this help from the church, he wouldn't have been able to molest me all this time, even in family issues. So if the church becomes aware and fails to act, those can be very troubling cases. And so it does, I think, put on us a little more requirement that if, let's suppose you got somebody on your board, let's just use a board example, and there's an allegation, and you're like, you know what, I like this guy, I don't think he did it, but right now, till this is done, he needs to come off the board. The church needs to take a separation and put themselves in a wait and see mode. And I will say, you don't always know. I mean, I had this scenario. A guy in Illinois called me. And he began the phone call with, I just want to bounce this off of you, but I don't plan to call the police. Now, how many understand as an attorney, that's always a little scary. Okay. Why do we not plan to call the police? You know, that's kind of a funny way to just want to make sure this is all cool with you. You know, okay, great, let's talk. Yes, sir.
So another kind of hypothetical. So I do children's ministry, and I have teams that serve.
And by the way, well, you're going to prison forever, but I like you. You know what I mean? Yeah, I'll visit you on holidays. If you need a file in your fruitcake, I'm your guy. Okay, go ahead.
So I have teens that serve in our children's ministry. They serve alongside adults. Like, it's very, very much so there's accountability there. Like, never would a teen be left alone with a kid. But kind of along the lines she was saying, so let's say something happens with a teen and a kid. Again, kind of along the same lines, not in the church. How far does that kind of responsibility extend? Like, if the kid, if something happens outside of church with that child, is that the same situation if they're in leadership, even their parents? Like, how far does that, make sense?
You know, it makes good sense. Okay, it makes good sense. Let me tell you what you're running into. Okay. You are mixing leadership and mentorship. Okay. I would be careful putting non-adults in leadership. Now, I get what you're saying. Okay, we're letting them do more. They're, you know, they're more active. But I would probably verbally, just for you as you think through this, look at this more as a mentorship or even a discipleship concept. Okay, we're not putting kids in charge of other kids, because that is a hard one. Because inevitably, how many understand teenagers do stupid. I mean, you're just inevitably. I mean, I don't care, the most godly, be your kid, someone else's kid. They're going to do something dumb, okay? And what I don't want is when they're passing around the peace pipe or sharing the liquor or whatever they're doing they shouldn't be doing, I'd rather not have that all tied to the church, okay? That's not us doing this. That's them doing it, okay? So keeping underage people out of per se leadership is probably a smart play, Okay. Now, can they still do things? Sure. Part of our mentorship, part of our discipleship, part of our training of you. You know, keep it at a level, because you're not paying them, right? I mean, these are volunteers. So just watch the terminology that you're not putting teens in leadership over other teens. Because if you do create that model, by the way, children's homes used to do it. Okay, they would have the more senior kids. These are all under 18, so they have 17-year-olds, and then a 14-year-old would get out of hand. And I mean, they had whole little protocols, you know, that, I mean, they'd pounce on them or they'd hand, you know, restrain them, but they'd have kids on kids, and they kind of had almost like a paramilitary pecking order. Well, all of that has been kind of blown up in litigation, that it just, it ends up being deemed as abusive and the organization's allowing it. So just be careful with the level of authority that you're investing in a team. And then realize that you do kind of own them. If they're driving and other kids are in the car, you kind of own it. If they're doing things that they shouldn't be doing at church activities, you probably own it. So just be careful that you're not delegating out too much authority to underage people. Let me tell you my guy in Illinois. He basically doesn't want to call the police. And I said, what's your story? A 13-year-old Facebook message to 14-year-old, please pray for me. My stepfather is molesting me. Okay. The parents see the message. They hit print. They hand it to the preacher. So what the preacher has is this piece of paper. And I said, well, preacher, why don't you want to turn that into the police? By the way, Illinois, along with a lot of other states, is heavy on mandatory reporter. And, you know, it's a criminal act not to. He said, well, two things, David. Number one, the girls involved are both immature girls. Okay. And I don't think they understand what they're saying. I said, okay, well, preacher, two things. Okay. A girl that's being abused, a lot of times will act immature. Okay. And number two, this is not tickle, hug, squeeze. You know, this is molestation. That word kind of has like one very bad meaning. There's no gray there. So I said, I would not use the naivete of the girls as a reason not to report to the authorities. He said, well, let me tell you the other reason. I said, what's the other reason? He said, the guy. He said, this guy is the number one giver in my church. Never misses a service. Is probably my best friend. If he wasn't divorced, he'd be on my board. I mean, I'm telling you, David, this guy, I wish I could have a whole church full of this guy. I mean, he's like amazing. I mean, I say something and he's there. He's there at work days. He's there visiting. I mean, there is probably not a bigger advocate for our church than this guy. He's like a superstar. And I just have a hard time believing that somebody that good could do anything that bad. I said, well, preacher, good news. I said, you don't have to decide. All you have to do is report, right? You turn in the paper, hand it to the police, and go from there. He says, I really am uncomfortable. I said, well, preacher, it's your choice, but legally, you're on, well, I'll do what's right. So he turned it in the authorities. Now, in this scenario, very sadly, the guy ended up being a serial abuser. And he had abused his stepdaughter. He had a lady. He was always able to use. He was an engineer for an auto company. He had a lot of personality, a lot of money. And so he was always able to use both charm and cash to kind of manipulate people. And as he had manipulated the pastor. And it was kind of interesting. In this case, the news reporters did a little story on it. And they talked about all of the teachers and all the healthcare professionals, all the social workers, everybody that should have noticed, never said a word. And then they said, but it took one brave pastor, and they highlighted him as the hero of the whole story. He called me a little sheepishly. He's like, I never even wanted to call. But we live in a world where you don't know. But you don't have to decide. You don't have to investigate. You don't have to evaluate. What you do is you report. And that is definitely where you are safe. And by the way, that's where a lot of what we're looking at in whether it's independent Baptist scandals, Southern Baptist scandals, other denominations, I'm not here to denomination bash, Catholic scandals, okay. What did they do? They had stuff internal and they didn't want to get in trouble, the people. And that there, and you get it. I mean, there's a priest shortage. Man, we can't get rid of all these guys. There's a pastor shortage. We can't get rid of all these guys. You know, send them to the mission field. We'll figure something out. You know, and so there's this, you know, let's rehab. They said they're sorry. And we, you know, they use the word we turned a blind eye or we shuffled it. But the reality is we didn't involve the government. We didn't report it. And that failure to report has really haunted a lot of the church world. Now, you say, well, why is it all coming to light today? I can tell you why. It's real easy. The internet. Okay? This has gone on a long time. Okay? There were kids being abused in the 30s and 40s. I wasn't around, but I'm telling you it was happening. There were kids being abused in the 50s and 60s. I wasn't around, but I'm telling you it happened. There are kids being abused in the 70s and 80s. I might have been beaten in the 70s and 80s, but the reality is it's been going on a long time. The internet has empowered victims to, number one, find each other, and number two, to communicate with advocates.
Yeah.
So the internet has brought all this to a great deal of attention. So if you say, well, is it ever going to go back to where it is, where the church could kind of handle it? No. We live in a world where optics and how it's managed, I mean, a lot of times when there's an abuse in your church, and it could even be a member, okay, and it doesn't have anything to do with the church, it just happened off property, you still have to be quick to communicate and get the word out as to where the church stands on these issues and make sure that they are very clear that we oppose all forms of child abuse, we check backgrounds, we supervise our workers, we do all of this in a way to keep children safe, because we believe if a child is safe anywhere, they should be safe at church. And by the way, how many agree with that statement?
Amen.
So let me walk you through our three, just to make them very clear, and then we'll take questions from the floor. Number one, the selection. You must be screening your workers. Now, I say that, this room, you all came to the seminar, you all agree with that, you're already probably in concept with me on that. So I won't even go into a lot of detail. But let me tell you what I'm finding in the court cases. We believe in it, we just don't do it. So I say, Adam, can you go get me the screening files for, you know, the elementary workers? And Adam goes, well, I hope we got some. I mean, I know we believe in it. You know, it's good stuff. But and here's what I would tell you to as leaders, okay? Leaders tend to instruct, but could I caution you that you also want to inspect. Little phrase I like, you don't get what you expect, you get what you inspect, right? I thought Mark had done all this. I'm in shock that we don't have any background checks done. And we actually had a predator in our Sunday school. Mark, how did that happen? Well, me yelling at Mark at this point doesn't do any of us any good because we're already in the lawsuit. We've already got an injured child. We've already got a bad situation. But if you, as a pastor, ministry leader, board member, say, hey, I would like to see the background check for this third grade teacher, this junior high person, matter of fact, I'd like to see the background check on our youth pastor. Can we look at that at the next board meeting? Obviously, confidentially, but just want to make sure we got all that. Oh, well, you thought we were doing the youth pastor? Well, I thought that was the pastor's job. I don't know. Well, third grade, I don't know that we did elementary. I think we do have that junior high one. How many understand you have a problem? Okay, what you have is a belief in background checks, but you don't have a system where you're executing on it. So my challenge to you, and by the way, it doesn't need to be onerous, doesn't need to be miserable, but set up a system. By the way, preschools do it all the time because they're not licensed to operate without everybody background checked. Christian day schools, private schools, public schools do it all the time. They're not licensed to operate without the background checks of everybody, all the volunteers, all the staff, all the people. So get somebody that's in that mode, okay? You know, generally, you know, kind of a secretarial, organized type person to make sure everybody's covered. And then I recommend that maybe once a year you have a training that you affirm all of this. You turn around and say, okay, all right, we got Ben's, okay, Justin's we got, ooh, we don't have Mark's, and you're able to make sure that all the background checks are in place. So make sure that you're doing that. Now, let me give you a good news here. You can use judgment, okay? If somebody 25 years ago did bad things, they have a felony record, they got saved, they've lived right for 25 years, you could use them in children's ministry. You can make a determination. But if they got arrested last week, how many believe probably not a good idea, okay? And if it's a crime against a child, how many understand that's a permanent ban? Okay. And somebody says, well, are you judgmental, legalistic, non-forgiving? Nope, I'm just smart. Okay, let me explain. The recidivism rate is real high with this type of thing. And by the way, if you have an embezzler in your church, I recommend they not be your church's treasurer or bookkeeper, okay? I'm just saying, not a good position for them. They can be something else, but keep them out of the money. I mean, brother, you were here, great man, great with finances, gifted in that. But the bottom line is, somebody says, hey, this guy's a former embezzler, we want to use him. I'd say, boy, not a good idea. You're just putting him in the wrong spot. And so in that vein, just be thinking about, you can't put somebody who is either convicted or admits to abusing a child in that type of leadership position. And by the way, sometimes they're a little arrogant. I mean, I've had people like, well, yeah, my daughter made those allegations, but that was before I got saved. And they want to kind of bluster a little bit. And preacher, I've never heard a kid here. You'd put me in a room with your daughter, wouldn't you? And preacher goes, well, yeah, probably, And they can get a little arrogant. Bottom line is, if they've got something in their background, for their protection, for the church's protection, and for the children's protection, they need to be out of those type of positions. So just make sure. And by the way, the higher up you go in the church, how many believe you ought to be able to be checking more? How many believe background checks on your board is not a bad idea? You're going to hire a pastor. How many believe you need to do more than just a background check? One church is like, what do you recommend? Oh, do a credit check, do a background check. Like, a credit check? Yeah. Found out the guy's, losing money everywhere, embezzled from churches everywhere. It all pops up on this credit check, stuff's everywhere. And is that who you want to put in charge of running this whole place? And so just make sure you're doing some level of due diligence. If you stand before a judge or a court and say, we were careful, we were systematic, you will win on selection. If you say, well, it was ministry, we're doing the best we could, then you will lose. And the jury will decide whether your behavior was reasonable. So, selection. Supervision. What does supervision translate to? Two things. Number one, training. And number two, written policies. And I would encourage the word written. Okay? Now, I like in your bylaws something that says we have zero tolerance for child abuse. I like that just because it looks good. It's almost like a statement of faith type level. But I don't want your whole child protection policy in your bylaws. That would be a little silly. Now, you could be a small church, and your written rules could be one page, okay? This church here, Shepherd's, would have a bigger book, okay? It could be 10, 12, 20 pages, because they have more things and more things to talk about and more areas of ministry. And obviously, nursery workers are different than elementary, and elementary is different than junior and senior high. So you can have different stages, but you want to have a written child protection plan. If you do not have one, email me. I'll send you a sample and you can play with it. But let me, and you're welcome to use it. I mean, incorporate it, do whatever you want with it. But my point is, you need to have something. Now, why is this important? Well, number one, your insurance policy will not even defend you if you don't have a written child protection policy. Okay. All the church insurance policies say, they're operating responsibly according to a written child protection plan. And if you don't have one, you go, oh, we never have one, the insurance carriers will walk on you. Okay, so you want to keep your insurance in play if there is an allegation. But number two, it gives you a blueprint to then walk your people through. When you do the annual training, you walk through all the policies. Let me give you a couple I like. Number one, we don't abuse children. How many believe that's a good rule, number one? You say, isn't that kind of the no-duh rule? It might be, but how many believe it just looks good when it's rule number one? And it sends a very big signal. I mean, if there's a bad actor out there, and these people are serious, that's like rule number one. And if it's up on a jury board, it looks nice, zero tolerance, we don't abuse kids, make it clear, and almost create a culture of safety. And I know we have always a balance, fun versus safe. I get that, zip lines are fun, but they're kind of dangerous. Zip lines over raging alligators and wild water, that's really fun, but really dangerous. There's always that balance, right? And so we got to kind of work through that a little bit. But in this case, people need to understand we don't tolerate abuse, and there's a culture of safety. Okay. Now, where that culture permeates in the real world is in the two-worker rule and in communication. Okay, those are the two things that you really need to key on from a church standpoint. We are not going to be alone with the children. Now, let me tell you why this is important. You'll be in court. There will be a decorated officer, head of Special Victims Unit, in uniform, looking very snappy. And he will present to the court with law enforcement authority the profile of a predator or a pedophile. And he will begin by saying, number one, they look for vulnerable children. And they will ask him, does this church look for vulnerable children? Yes, in my opinion, they do. Okay. Number two, they become people of trust over the vulnerable children. Officer expert, in your opinion, does this church become persons of trust over these vulnerable children? Yes, in my opinion, they do. They call them pastors, teachers, commanders, leaders. You know, they use all the language. Yes, they do. Number three, what the predator will do is from their position of trust, they will do kind things for the vulnerable children. Officer, in your professional opinion, does this church, from its positions of trust, do kind things for the children? Oh, not only do they do kind things, they raise money from the older people to pay for these kind things. They broadcast them. They market them. They put them on their website. There's Facebooks. They do a lot of kind things for these vulnerable children. And that's exactly the profile of a predator. Yes, it is. The fourth thing that the predator will do is they isolate the child. And how many believe that's where we need to snip it? If you isolate the child, you're pretty much down the slippery slope. Because we are going to do kind things. We're going to minister to the hurting kids of our community. We are positions of trust. We have to kind of accept that's the first three. But we say, no, we're never alone with these kids. We do not isolate them. We don't take them off by ourselves. We're not alone with them. We do not. Matter of fact, we don't even text them. We only do group text, or we do... And watch that one, William, because with the kids, the texting's everywhere. But the bottom line is we do not isolate the children. And that's where you snip it. Because if they can show isolation, music rooms alone, prayer rooms alone, by themselves alone, then they say then the abuse occurs, and then the cover-up. Those are the steps. And the cover-up is actually worse than the abuse psychologically. We know abuse is horrible, and I'm not trying to minimize it. There's victims here, I apologize. But the point is, kids are resilient, they bounce back from trauma, but the cover-up is ongoing. So after the abuse occurs, they say to the kid, you know, that's your fault. I didn't want to do it. What? I thought you wanted to do it. Oh, well, you tell anybody, I'm going to have to kill your parents. What, you're going to kill my parents? You know, and it's the ongoing cover-up that creates all the psychological lasting trauma, even beyond the horror of whatever they experienced physically or sexually. So that's going to be the profile, and it's important as a church that you say, we are not alone with the kids. Now, a lot of times it's being nice. You know, parents didn't show up, kids don't have a ride, hop in my car. How many understand the hair on your neck needs to go up? You're alone with a kid. They say, well, I got to do it. Well, be smart about it. You know, put the kid in the back seat, buckle him in, turn on your cell phone camera. You know, be thinking, man, I'm alone with a kid. This is a high-risk moment. Okay? Try to avoid those situations. The texting. Most grooming, most abuse is occurring over the cell phone. The cell phones have gotten smarter than the people. We all know that. But these kids are really good with them. I mean, and so we have situations. I mean, I had here in North Carolina, a youth pastor started counseling a girl on the cell phone. He's 28 years old, grew up in the church, perfect background, great guy, Bible school, seminary, the whole deal. But this little 13-year-old girl and he start texting. And I firmly believe that the 28-year-old did not begin the texting with the goal of having a sexual relationship. I really believe that. I think it was kind of one of these, like, curiosities. How many understand? People dip into sin sometimes. They don't just go crashing it, okay? But he and this girl start texting. They start developing a special relationship. And then one night he's like, you know, I'd like to go out for ice cream. And the girl's like, well, I'm in bed. You know, my parents will, well, don't tell your parents. They're going to say you can't. He said, I'll tell you what, I'm driving past your house real slow. If you want to go for ice cream, let me know. And the little girl paddles out, 14 now, whatever her age, early teen. and in her pajamas, hops in the car. And you know what? Predators aren't stupid either. That first night, all they did was go get ice cream. You know, because what if he gets caught, he can say she was running away and I gave her ice cream and took her home. He needs to test her. See, remember too, he don't want to get caught. He's married and works for a church. So can she keep her mouth shut? Is she going to blab this through the whole youth group? I got to be a plausible deniability. I mean, predators are sneaky sorts. And once you start into that lifestyle, well, once he figures out he can trust her, then he starts more manipulation. You know, my wife is dying. I mean, understand there's always a story, right? So God brought you into my life to be my new wife. And once she dies, but we don't want to hurt her, so we're not going to tell her. And all this is made up, but it works in the mind of the girl. So now she's in love, going to be married, and you can imagine the abuse went on for years. Until one day, the parents found something on a cell phone. And, you know, the pastor, how many believe he had a bad day? Here's his youth pastor, here's key family in his church, here's a tough situation. He did the right thing, he called the police, and that guy's going to jail forever. I mean, North Carolina doesn't mess around. By the way, if you're ever tempted, nobody here would be, but if you're ever tempted to abuse a child, remind people that every time you do something, it's a separate crime. Murder is one and done. You shot somebody, they're dead. Not good, but you might get out. Every time you touch a child, that's a separate crime. That's why some of these people get sentenced to 400 years. You know, I mean, it just stacks up unbelievably. So this guy is going to jail forever. Okay. And the pastor said, David, we did the background checks, we did the training, we had policies. What could we have done? I said, Pastor, I don't know. But I said, the one thing I'd have suggested is if you'd had the no texting policy, this girl, her family might have alerted you early before things got out of hand. This guy might not have been texting these kids one-on-one. So just recognize, a lot of public schools have gone to a, you text, you're fired. I don't even want to know what's in the text. They have message boards and other things, but they're just kind of done with that liability. So you've got selection, you've got supervision. We've talked about retention. Something comes up, you have a duty to investigate, you have a duty to report, and just be careful. Pastors sometimes fall into the, let me pray about it, let me think about it, I'll get to it, maybe this will play out, maybe it'll quiet down, and that ends up hurting you. Because it does not look like the church is moving aggressively. Our ministry is available to you. If you have a situation come up, these are always tough and a little fact specific, but we will be a resource and a help to you. I think we've got 2 minutes left, so open the floor to any questions or anything you want to ask. Yes, sir.
Should churches define gender to protect themselves, or would it not?
I recommend you do, okay? And put it in some degree of statement of faith, and we can give you some sample language, but that, you know, we recognize, you know, gender as being how God created you at birth, you know, something to that effect. And then also marriage, we recommend you have a positive statement, you know, instead of saying we oppose, you know, homosexuality and adultery and bestiality, all these bad things, you know, just say we believe marriage is between one man, one woman, as their gender was determined at birth, and that any sexual activity outside this covenantal union is sin, regardless of what the courts or the culture may say. You know, that then puts a positive definition, and then you don't have to worry about all the bizarrety of the culture. Yes, sir?
So, was to be in a church situation where the children are seen to outnumber the church members. So we've got like 69 members and about 72 children. So the two-worker policy doesn't seem to be available. Is there a good alternative to that, like cameras in the classrooms?
Yeah, let me say a couple things, okay? And I don't want to argue with you because obviously it's an individualized church assessment, okay? Mm-hmm. Are you bringing in the kids or these drive-in kids? Be careful. I mean, I've been at churches that had 40 people and they bust in 500, and I'm telling you, it was chaos, okay? So make sure you can manage and handle what you got, okay? Don't create. So there are things such as ratios. You know, can we handle, if you got one little old lady, you can't go have 400 kids for VBS. Okay, you got a ratio, figure out what you got, okay? But presuming these are just regulars driving in, two models. One model is cluster them more. Okay, nowhere in the Bible does it say the fourth grade boys and the fourth grade girls and the fifth grade. You say, that's the way we've always done it. Well, put fourth, fifth, and sixth together, put fourth to eighth together, you know. So, and again, facilities play into this. Open door policies, roving person in the hallway, those are less technological ways to at least provide a second worker. So like if we're in a classroom alone, but there's somebody out in the hallway kind of walking regularly. Cameras are always good. A lot of schools have done that. But here's the issue with cameras. Do we have the fortitude to keep them working? And do we have the diligence to actually monitor them? Okay. Because a camera can be a death knell for you. I mean, I had a nursery case. This was actually a preschool where the cameras caught the worker spanking a little naked three-year-old. You know, and the mother used the cameras to get the lady put in jail. So just realize cameras cut both ways. How many understand the police like and hate cameras? Because on one hand, it defends them. On the other hand, it incriminates them. So just whatever you put on film, just make sure you realize it's on film. And then if, yes, sir.
Oh, sorry. You're welcome to finish.
No, we're good. I'm moving quickly.
So with the two-person policy, we have that in place. One of the issues I could see with that, and I don't know if you have any suggestions, a lot of wife and husband serve together.
I don't have a problem with that. Here's why. Okay, let me say husband and wife. If your wife is on the witness stand and I go, now you're married to Mark, yes I am, and you love Mark, yep, and you're here to testify and you know the allegations against Mark, yes I do. Has Mark asked you to lie? No. Would you lie for Mark? I mean, if Mark did something, would you lie to this jury right now and tell them, no, I wouldn't lie. Matter of fact, if Mark hurt a kid, what would you do? I'd call the police and have him arrested. Okay, good. Hey, I'm glad you're a strong, smart wife. Now let's talk about what happened on this day. So I find that you can generally get a spouse bolstered up in credibility. The reason why some churches don't want spouses is they're like, well, I like independent witnesses. The problem with that is getting enough volunteers. It's hard to find them. People like working with their spouse, so sometimes it comes to family ministry. I do recommend, however, and this is just me, you don't have to agree with me, but keeping the men out of the nursery, and I don't say that to be sexist, I just say that most allegations are against men, so men statistically get the higher allegation, and if somebody says, I feel like my baby was touched inappropriately, I just hate to have a guy standing there trying to defend how he changed the diaper or something. Women get a little of the maternal, a little more of the grandmother, mother, benefit. So I do recommend, you know, your nursery workers probably be all women. Again, if you can do it. And again, I know some churches don't agree with that, but I'm just saying it's a risk management issue. It's not a legal mandate. It's just it's safer that way. Any other questions? I know we have sessions coming up. I don't want to make you late or long. Let me say this. If you fill out the card, and I've got one here, turn it in. I will make sure that you get our newsletter. If you'd like a child protection policy or something, just write it on there, and I'll have them email it to you and send it to you. It's a sample. You can change it. You can adjust it. It may not fit your church. That's fine. Don't feel any stress on that. And then if NCLL can be a friend or resource, you have our pen contact information. And I hope you have a final rest of your morning. I guess the conference is almost done. Have you been enjoying Shepherd's? Has it been a good time? So thank you for being here, and you are dismissed.
Thanks for listening to this session from the 2021 Shepherd's 360 International Church Leaders Conference. This material is copyrighted and may not be altered or sold. For information, visit shepherds360.org.